This is Molly Hemingway, encouraging you to listen to my favorite podcast, Issues, Etc. Every day you get in-depth interviews with host Todd Wilkin asking expert guests substantive, thought-provoking questions on all of the important news and issues of our day. The expert guests are in culture, law, ethics, philosophy, theology, and apologetics. Expert guests, expansive topics, always extolling Christ. Issues, etc.
While pro-lifers are happy that Dobbs turned out the way it did and Roe v. Wade finally fell and likely will not return again, while we're happy about this, we have to acknowledge that in the majority opinion in the Dobbs decision, there are some weaknesses, some things that are missing, and some things that the court should have considered. What are those things, and what's the relationship of natural law to the basic laws that we all live with every day and the U.S. Constitution? Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Joining us to talk about natural law and the U.S. Constitution, Hadley Arkus. He's professor emeritus of jurisprudence at Amherst College. He's founder of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and the American Founding. He's architect of the bill that became the Born Alive Infants Protection Act, and he's author of several books, including his latest, Mirror Natural Law, Originalism, and the Anchoring Truths of the Constitution. Hadley, welcome back.
Always good to be here, Todd. Thanks so much for having me on.
You say that natural law has always been with us. What do you mean by that?
It's a law that tells you why you are justified in having laws, and it's a law that tells you what a law is in the first place. Immanuel Kant used to say, before we have any kind of positive law, the law that's enacted, regulations put in place, before you have, say, speed laws, with signs saying 65 miles per hour, 35 miles per hour, before you have that positive law, there's an underlying natural law that tells you why you're justified in having a law in the first place, why you're justified in having a law that may restrain the freedom of people to drive at speeds that put innocent life at hazard. So the natural law tells you just what is a law and why it's binding. Would you be able to try a little problem with me for a moment?
Sure.
So you get the natural reaction to things. In a book of mine years ago called The Philosophy of the City, I recalled an X-rated scene on Capitol Hill with a woman named Judith Denson-Gerber giving slides and a presentation on the abuse of children. Now, I don't want it to get graphic for your audience, but she had examples of, shall we say, sexually transmitted diseases in an 18-month-old girl and a 9-month-old infant. And now let's say you confronted somebody like that. You found a man who was doing that with his children. Now, the natural question is, how do we react to that? Do we say, let's give him a tax incentive and induce him to stop? Let's give him a DVD player. Let's make a contract. And that usually brings giggles. The normal response to that, I think the natural response would be to command him to stop doing it. And in other words, it's a response of a wrong. You're doing something wrong, something you ought not do. Let's say we responded with a law, we'd say, who should not do this? Simply this Jones who's doing this to his child? Or would we say that anyone doing this should be forbidden by the law? So in other words, once we come to an understanding of something that is so wrong that we would forbid it, we can forbid it with the force of law. And that's the classic connection between the logic of morals and the logic of law, as we see coming out of Aristotle. We have laws because we have finally reached judgments about the kinds of things that are wrong for anyone to do. So we forbid those acts universally to everyone who comes within the reach of the statute. If we bar racial discrimination in private businesses open to transactions with the public, the law applies to everyone who is in that kind of a business. So the natural law just reminds us of the moral logic that constitutes law. We have law only because we are able to move away from statements of really personal feeling, private taste,
Just think about the kinds of things that are more generally or universally right or wrong, good or bad, for others as well as ourselves. To say if slavery is wrong, for whom is it wrong to be enslaved? For whom is it wrong to own slaves? The answer coming back in a moral voice is anyone, everyone. Well, once you put that in place, you understand why you have laws in the first place. It's because of the capacity to reason over matters of right and wrong is simply locked into our nature. You know, as Aristotle used to say, animals can emit sounds to indicate pleasure or pain, but what's natural to human beings is the capacity to give reasons over matters of right and wrong. And it's from that natural capacity that the notion of law arises. So the natural law there tells us that, again, why we'd be justified having laws and what would be a law. But the point I'm making in this new book, I'm saying mere natural law, is that I'm following a good friend of mine, Dan Robinson, a late friend, who spent his last years at Oxford, saying he wanted as the epitaph on his tombstone, he died without a theory. And when he said that, he was really recalling Thomas Reed, the great Scots philosopher, who's read closely at the American founding by James Wilson, John Adams, who was appealing to those precepts of common sense, those things that the ordinary person has to know and has to take for granted in life, in getting on with the business of life, before he can start trafficking in theories. And so, as we'd say, before the average man would start bantering with David Hume about the meaning of causation, he knows his own active powers to cause his own acts to happen. So the point I'm making in the book, Todd, is that this is where the American founders began. These are the principles that were there before we had the Constitution. These were the principles of right and wrong and the principles of lawfulness that the founders drew upon as they framed the Constitution. The Constitution was not the source of their moral understanding about these principles. And as the founders understood, some of those principles would be there even if there were no Constitution, much in the way that John Quincy Adams, that right to petition the government would be there even if it hadn't been mentioned in the First Amendment. It would be there even if there were no First Amendment. It would be there even if there were no Constitution. It's grounded in a principle that was there before the Constitution and would be true even if there were no Constitution. So we're trying to take people back to those precepts of common sense that the ordinary person had to understand, and which was taken, I think, by the American founders as the very ground of the natural law, the law that was there before they framed the Constitution.
Why is natural law anathema to the left?
Because, of course, the natural law begins with the notion there are indeed moral truths. More than that, necessary moral truths. Truths you can't deny without falling into contradictions. Truths that must be absorbed on their own terms, like the law of contradiction. Two contradictory things cannot both be true. They're objective truths about the way we are constituted that run counter to the deep claims of the liberal side in our politics, as seen most importantly in the whole scheme of sexual liberation. To detach our sexual lives from any anchoring truths or objective truths about the way we are constituted as sexual beings, as males and females. That's been so much part of the liberal agenda to liberate people, to open up their choices by detaching them from those kinds of moral principles that will offer restraints on the kinds of things that people might be tempted to do.
How did natural law come to be ignored by both conservatives and liberals on the U.S. Supreme Court?
That is a terrific question. The conservatives were recoiling from what they saw as the inventiveness and overreach of liberal justices inventing new rights that were not in the text, whether it's right to have a lawyer from the first moments, or, but more critically, the right to an abortion. And the conservatives were drawn to the line that the problem there was not that this reasoning of the liberals, of the left, in finding a right to abortion, not that it was just some founded and specious reasoning, false reasoning, but that the vice came in inventing a right that was not found in the text of the Constitution. So the argument was, abortion is nowhere contained in the text of the Constitution. Therefore, federal judges are not in a position to articulate, proclaim any rights emanating from the Constitution. But of course, marriage was not in the Constitution when the court struck down interracial marriage in 1967. And as my dear friend Jerry Bradley at Notre Dame has pointed out, the federal government had ample reason to be dealing with the matter of abortion in military outposts, with diplomatic outposts abroad, in the territories, the District of Columbia. It's not that abortion is just nowhere within the business of the federal government. But the point is that instead of addressing the substance of the argument, like 50 years ago, when Roe versus Wade was done, the lawyers from Texas offered an exquisite brief drawing on most updated findings of embryology to point out that that offspring in the womb had never been anything other than human from its first moments. It received its nourishment from the mother, but it was never merely a part of the mother's body. Well, the conservatives who were dissenting never drew on any of that. It was indeed possible for the court to say at the time, the state of Texas has given us ample grounds to understand that we are dealing with human lives being destroyed in abortion. The laws on homicide have ever been indifferent to the size, the age, the weight of the victim. And the conservatives said the problem there was that the court simply made the wrong decision. It didn't recognize the force, the compelling force of the argument put before them. But instead, the conservatives simply hold to the notion that it was judicial overreach. It was abuse of power because abortion was nowhere contained in the text of the Constitution. And so one of the results now, as you see with the Dobbs case about a year ago, is that the six conservative judges voted to overturn Roe versus Wade as a legal holding, but they would not declare and pronounce on the human standing of the child in the womb. They still would not address, bring into their opinion, the objective truth that lies at the heart of the matter. Because they've talked themselves into the notion that somehow addressing those questions of moral substance must be beyond the reach of judges, that the issue must be left to people in the political arena. But of course, without recognizing that you're dealing with a human life being snuffed out, we don't know what these cases are really about. It can't possibly give us a coherent account of what we're doing as we're addressing these cases.
Hadley Arkus is our guest, Professor Emeritus of Jurisprudence at Amherst College. When we come back, how does he respond to the argument that since transcendent moral truths are not universally recognized, they don't exist? We're talking with him about natural law and the U.S. Constitution.
This is Molly Hemingway, encouraging you to listen to my favorite podcast, Issues, Etc. Every day you get in-depth interviews with host Todd Wilkin asking expert guests substantive, thought-provoking questions on all of the important news and issues of our day. The expert guests are in culture, law, ethics, philosophy, theology, and apologetics. Expert guests, expansive topics, always extolling Christ. Issues, etc.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your service.
Our church loves and is grateful for those that serve our country. Operation Barnabas, part of Ministry to the Armed Forces, equips you to reach out to veterans in your community to bring Christ to those that served. Call Ministry to the Armed Forces at 314-996-1337 or email lcmschaps@lcms.org.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
God bless our military.
Many educational institutions are governed by the whims of culture and are increasingly hostile to the Word of God. In contrast, Faith Lutheran School in Plano, Texas, provides classical Lutheran education rooted in God's Word for students preschool through grade 12. Simply put, we equip students to stand firm in the faith through solid education focused on wisdom and virtue. We offer in-person instruction as well as live online classes for remote learning. To learn more, visit flsplano.org, flsplano.org.
America's tradition of liberty depends on having colleges and universities that equip young people for the responsibilities of freedom. At Concordia University Chicago, freedom is a pillar of our education. We prepare our students to live as free, self-governing citizens. I'm Dr. Rachel Ferguson, Director of the Free Enterprise Center at Concordia Chicago. I invite you to visit us. Discover what it means for freedom to become a pillar of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Not only does our church need men right now, but the world needs men who will proclaim the gospel in its purity.
Issues, Etc. regular guest, Dr. Peter Scair, Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
If when you go to sleep at night, you're thinking about it, my experience with it is this, is that thought won't go away. So if you're going to bed at night thinking about following our Lord and becoming a preacher of this gospel, then I would love if you could come and visit Fort Wayne, our campus. We'd love to show you around and show you what it is that we do.
Have you ever considered becoming a pastor? Contact Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155, or visit ctsfw.edu. Christ-centered, cross-focused, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're talking with Hadley Arkus, author of Mirror Natural Law, Originalism, and the Anchoring Truths of the Constitution about Natural Law and the U.S. Constitution. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. Hadley, how do you respond to the argument that since transcendent moral truths aren't universally recognized, transcendent moral truths don't exist?
Well, it reduces to the proposition that the presence of disagreement marks the absence of truth, and of course, I'd register my disagreement with that proposition. It's a self-refuting proposition. The fact that some things are not universally recognized does not mean that the truths are not there. You're simply telling us about what people have yet failed to recognize. If you told me that 20% of the population doesn't really understand the law of contradiction, the two contradictory propositions both cannot be true, that hardly affects the truth of the proposition. Or take the point that stands as really the first principle of all moral and legal judgment, a critical anchoring point in our law, which the ordinary person would get at this way by asking, what would you say if you were told that Jones, accused of burglary, was in intensive care following surgery when the crime was committed? And the average man would say, well, why are you prosecuting? That is, the ordinary person would know that the first principle of law and legal judgment, which was, it makes no sense to cast judgments of praise or blame on people when they were powerless to affect the act in question. So we don't hold people blameworthy for acts they were powerless to affect. Now, let's say we grasp that as one of those, again, one of those things to be grasped, as they used to say, per se nota, as true in itself. The way we grasp the law of contradiction, the two contradictory things cannot both be true. Now, if somebody told us there is no consensus on that, do we find people who somehow don't understand that people may not be held blameworthy, responsible for acts they were powerless to affect? Nothing in that report would shake us in our confidence about the truth of that first anchoring principle. My old friend, Justice Scalia, used to say, well, we can't get consensus on these moral truths. And his friends would say, ah, did you get a consensus on that point? That we need a consensus before we can establish truth? No, because we didn't get our balance. The point is that it's simply not tenable to work on the assumption the very presence of disagreement must mark the absence of truth. It's hard to imagine anything we could name that could not elicit disagreement or incomprehension. And none of that would indicate that there are no truths out there to be understood.
Then how do we have access to natural law?
Through the laws of reason. And Alexander Hamilton sort of had it in the Fetters 31. He was explaining this thing. He said, in disquisitions of every kind, these are primary truths or first principles that you must be able to grasp per se nota as true in itself, as with the law of contradiction. as a law of contradiction. The way people grasp that, it makes no sense to hold people responsible for acts they were powerless to effect. If Jones had not been born when the crime was committed, it makes no sense to prosecute him. Well, to build an actual law out of things of that kind, of things that you grasp per se nota, and they become the ground of other propositions. So once you understand, say, an anchoring proposition that you know, as John Stuart Mill used to say, we stop using the language of right or wrong. We stop using the language of likes and dislikes and start using the language of right and wrong as we think people may rightly be punished for what they're doing. But at the same time, by the logic of justice, if we respect the difference between innocence and guilt, then we commit ourselves to making that discrimination by using the most demanding canons of evidence in testing the evidence brought forth against an accused, rather than simply having an accused run over hot coals or bear up pummeling over his shoulders. And once you follow down the line, you then come out with the recognition that any person accused of a crime should have access to the witnesses and evidence against him for the sake of rebutting them, and rebutting them, offering a verdict that is substantively accurate in distinguishing between innocence and guilt and avoiding the punishment of an innocent person. Now, see, from that very simple point, Todd, you extract the whole system of law, as we've seen it. So many important things spring from those elementary propositions. But the point is that the anchoring propositions are things that the ordinary person himself understands as a point of common sense. He sees one person hitting another. He understands that one person caused this to happen. He understands that responsibility or blame could be assigned. And it's natural then to ask the question, well, how is this act justified? Look, you see the way ordinary people handle these things. In Washington, in my own building a couple of years ago, we were put out on the grounds because the fire department was fighting a fire. We're out there for a couple of hours, Todd, and people were vexed, let me tell you. Nobody was pleased to be out there, and our liberty to enter our own apartments was being barred. And yet no one thought our rights were being violated. And this, our liberty was restricted, but we could see that it was restricted for a justification that encompassed the protection of innocent life and our own lives. This is the way normal people naturally think about these. I see a youngster about to go into the subway in Connecticut Avenue, Washington, with a bicycle. And I said, can you do that? And he said, yes, but not during rush hours. He knows it's unreasonable to take up space for two or three other people by having a bicycle there. In other words, he knows his liberty is being restricted. But he has no quarrels about this. He doesn't think his rights are being restricted, because his liberty is being restricted with justification. My point, Todd, is that ordinary people do these things every day. They naturally think this way. They cast the problem in those moral terms. They understand they react if they're hurt, if they're treated dismissively, and they want to know what the justification is for it. It's the way ordinary people think about these things. And there's nothing inscrutable about them. You don't need a college education in order to understand these things.
We're talking with Hadley Arkus about natural law and the U.S. Constitution. When we come back, he uses the story of Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas to demonstrate moral judgment and its utility in the law.
The demise of society's understanding of the basic meaning of marriage, the challenges to religious liberty, and the attacks on innocent human life are all interrelated.
San Francisco Archbishop Salvatore Corleone talking about his presentation at the 2023 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
A rightly ordered understanding of male-female complementarity is the basis for a healthy society, one that is conducive to human flourishing and also is at the heart of a Christian civilization. This is not just theory. It is borne out by practical experience.
You can meet and hear Archbishop Corleone making the case for speaking the truth to power at this year's Making the Case Conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, June 16th and Saturday, June 17th at Concordia University, Chicago.
Registration is $160 and includes three meals. On-campus dorm options are available. You'll find a conference schedule, and you can register at issuesetc.org.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Life Ministry is thousands of people sharing Christ's love and mercy and giving witness to our Lord's creation of life, His design for marriage and the family, and the God-given value of all human life from conception to natural death. Working with many partners, LCMS Life Ministry sponsors human care efforts that meet the needs of body and soul and provides resources and educational events for all ages. To learn more, email lifeministry@lcms.org and visit lcms.org/life.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
The Substitute Organist Service, aptly abbreviated SOS, really has come to our rescue.
Pastor Jim Hollowatch of Christ Lutheran Church in Jackson, Mississippi.
With the ever-growing shortage of skilled musicians in our community, we were approaching a real crisis. But thanks to the Substitute Organist Service, help is always just minutes away. With its easy, intuitive interface, friendly customer service, and outstanding musicianship, you really couldn't ask for more.
You can find out more about the Substitute Organist Service at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. On this Friday, May the 12th, we're talking natural law in the U.S. Constitution with Hadley Arkus, Professor Emeritus of Jurisprudence at Amherst College. Hadley, what is moral judgment and how did Abraham Lincoln use it to destroy Stephen Douglas's position regarding slavery?
Well, part of the argument here was that fragment that Lincoln wrote himself, imagining himself into a conversation with an owner of slaves, putting questions, why are you justified enslaving this black man? Is it because he is less intelligent than you? Beware. The next white man who comes along, more intelligent than you, may rightly enslave you. Is it because he's darker than you are? The lighter skin having the right to enslave the darker? Beware again. The next white man who comes along with a complexion even lighter than yours may rightly enslave you. And then the upshot here is there's nothing one could cite to disqualify the black man as a human being and as bare of rights that would not apply to many whites as well. There is no appeal to revelation or faith. It's simply a model of principled reasoning. It's accessible to people across the religious division. It brings out Aquinas' point that the divine law we know through revelation, but the natural law we know through the reasoning that is accessible to human beings as human beings. This example I've just given you, Todd, Lincoln, in that fragment he wrote for himself, in my experience as a teacher, it's hard to find anything that is more readily and instantly understood the moment it is heard. You don't need, it's simply principled reasoning. There's no appeal to faith. You don't need a college education to understand it. Now, the argument with Douglas was that Douglas wanted to hold open the possibility of the new territories voting slavery in or out. And as Lincoln said, if you understood it was wrong, if you understand, for example, it is wrong for a parent to torture a child, you'd say, well, no one has the right to choose it. No one has the right to do it wrong. If you understood that there was something wrong in slavery, you'd understand that you wouldn't have the right to vote it up or down. So Lincoln's policy was, at the time, not to interfere with slavery where it was, but to affirm the moral understanding of the wrongness of slavery. And therefore, it should not enter into new territories. And it should be the ground of a policy to bar its extension into the West, to bar the import of new slaves from abroad. And by getting clear on the wrongness of it, help put slavery in the course of ultimate extinction. So I think you might have been referring also to the part of Lincoln's argument where it's a more complicated. You're referring to the Dred Scott decision that people may not be deprived of their property of slaves when they enter a territory of the United States. Is that what you're referring to?
Well, it's I believe it was Douglass's attempt to straddle the issue of right and wrong on slavery.
You have really read me, Todd. Thanks so much. You really read that book. Yeah, he was trying to straddle the issue. He had to defend the southern wing of his party in holding to the rightness of the decision in the famous Dred Scott case that a person may not be deprived of his property and slaves, but enter a territory, not a state, into a territory of the United States. The territories not yet formed into states. But at the same time, he tried to appeal to his northern and western wings of people who were not in favor of slavery and would rather have slavery out of the territories. So one of the problems here is that with the straddle is that if slavery really was wrong, then the people in the territories would not be free to vote it in. And so he had to cope with this problem. And it had to defend the decision of the Dred Scott case. And his answer was a kind of attempt to finesse the whole matter by saying, look, you may have this right to own slaves, your right not to be dispossessed of your property as slaves, but your practical capacity to preserve that right will depend on local law. If the local laws do not support your right, if they put up certain kinds of hindrances or resistance, you'll not be able to maintain it. So the argument from Douglass is, okay, yes, the people in the South have the right not to be dispossessed of their property and a slave, but don't worry, you people in the North have the freedom just to obstruct it when it comes about. And Lincoln says, this is a monstrous doctrine. You're telling me that I have a right to do X, but people are free to obstruct it. If I have a right, say, to go to my home, people are not free to obstruct my passage to my home. They'd be obliged rather to facilitate it or support it. You can't say at the same time that there's something like a constitutional right not to be dispossessed of my property as slaves, and say at the same time that people in the separate states in the North will be free to obstruct it. It makes a nullity of a constitutional right. And Lincoln points out that part of the Constitution itself is the fugitive slave clause. Nominated in the body, it's something we have to accept in order to have this Constitution, the obligation to return slaves, making their way into the northern states, return slaves to their places of origin. You couldn't have had the Constitution without that kind of assurance to the South. Now, the right, the fugitive slave clause, the right of slave owners to have their slaves returned was now a constitutional right. Now, Lincoln turns and says, are you telling me now if it's a constitutional right to have my slaves returned, but at the same time you're telling me that people in the North can refuse to honor that right, they can obstruct that right? And he says, wow, my goodness, if that's true, there's no greater abolitionist in the country than Douglass after all. That by taking the position he's not doing, he's cutting the very ground out from respecting the fugitive slave clause. And of course, what the South, in making that argument, Lincoln not only destroyed Douglass's argument, he destroyed his political prospects, because what the South wanted was a slave code to govern the territories. And Douglass was just not in a position to give them that. So he couldn't gain the presidential nomination of a united Democratic Party, the Democratic Party split, making possible Lincoln's own election. But again, it all came aground because of this proposition that if there is a right, it cannot be possible for other people to obstruct that right. It cannot be legitimate to obstruct or resist that right. If there is a right, people be obliged, rather, to respect the right. It's the logic of what a moral judgment is. As Lincoln put it a year later, Douglass is telling you, he said, you have a right to resist the extension of slavery into your state by saying, Douglas is telling you that a thing may be rightly driven out of the place where it has a right to be. Again, it's the logic of moral judgment. If it's something is right, then the response is that the rest of us are obliged to respect it, not to undo it and resist it or overturn it.
We're talking about natural law and the U.S. Constitution with Hadley Arkus, Professor Emeritus of Jurisprudence at Amherst College, founder of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and the American Founding. He's architect of the bill that became the Born Alive Infants Protection Act and author of several books, including his latest, Mere Natural Law, Originalism, and the Anchoring Truths of the Constitution. The 2023 Lutherans for Life National Conference is October 11th through the 13th at the Holiday Inn Cincinnati Airport. This year's conference includes visits to the Creation Museum and the Ark Encounter. Find out more about the speaking lineup and register at lutheransforlife.org, lutheransforlife.org. On the other side, how are natural law and those natural rights related to one another?
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I am accepted because I'm a part of His family through Jesus' shed blood.
Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in His ways.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about natural law and the U.S. Constitution with Hadley Arkus. In about a half hour, we'll discuss the normalization of pedophilia with Jane Robbins. Hadley, how are natural law and natural rights related?
There's some different sides of the same issue. I know that people want to say a big difference between natural law and natural rights, but we're dealing, in either case, with an anchoring truth, a moral truth, an objective truth. It can't simply be reduced to subjective feelings. Now, if it's wrong to hold somebody responsible or blameworthy for things he was powerless to affect, powerless to do, you might say on the other side that somebody has a right not to be held blameworthy, responsible for acts he was powerless to affect. It's simply two sides of the same thing. But the critical point, again, is at the center of the whole thing. What makes a profound difference is you're dealing with a moral truth that is simply not reducible to simply subjective feelings. Whether it's right or wrong to hold me responsible for acts that my powers to affect has nothing to do with your personal feelings.
How were civil rights promoted without an appeal to natural law?
Again, that's really fine. What we saw happening was, say, in the cases of racial segregation, the argument was that if kids are segregated on the basis of race in the schools, that will impair their morale and their capacity to learn. But then the question was raised, if the kids are separated on the basis of race and the reading scores go up, has the segregation ceased to be wrong? Or is it wrong in principle? And people raised the question years ago over one great professor years ago at the University of Chicago asked, how do we get from segregation in the schools in Brown versus Board of Education to segregation in the swimming pools in the Palmer case? He said, I thought that the people were telling me that the wrong of segregation involves some harm inflicted on black children in schools. Are you saying that being deprived, being barred from getting access to a public swimming pool, that would be impairing their capacity to learn? And the question is, are we saying this, the wrong is simply contingent on things happening in schools? We said there's something in principle wrong, something that would make it wrong to bar black people from entering businesses, private clubs, swimming pools. In that case, but the problem is that the civil rights movement kept casting its arguments in terms of speculations about the effects. If black people are not allowed to, are discouraged from traveling in interstate commerce, then businesses will be doing less business. There'll be a reduced volume of trade. There'll be fewer orders for meat, linen, silverware. And so then what is the wrong done to black people? It's going to interfere with the interstate flow of meat. This doesn't give an account of what the real principle is. So I can argue years ago that the real problem is one of kind of determinism. People falling into the assumption that if they know the race of someone, they're in a position of interesting moral inferences as to whether they're dealing with a good or bad person, deserves to be welcomed or shunned. And the problem is that every one of us is a member of a race. If you're telling us that race exerts a deterministic control over our conduct, you're telling us no one is responsible for his own acts. If that's true, the whole language of moral judgment of right and wrong just dissolves. It makes no sense to cast judgments on people if their conduct is determined by forces outside their control. Let's say we came to the judgment that, no, it was simply wrong in principle to draw in moral inferences about people. But what you think they deserved or what fault they have simply by knowing their race, you understand, if it's true, that is true, it may be just as wrong to assign benefits and disabilities to people on the basis of race, to award contracts to minority figures, and giving an accent to minorities as opposed to whites. It still involves the same kind of discrimination in principle. But for years, I think the civil rights movement was trying to just sought to avoid that question, because I wanted to argue case by case that there was just racial segregation was just not equal, it's not producing the right effects in any one of these cases. But after years, in fact, there's a friend of mine, a late trustee at Amherst College, a great black figure, Bill Hastie, who was one of the first black federal judges. And he was arguing a case in the court in the 1940s where the strategy was just to keep it focused on why segregation just produces ill effects. He's arguing one of the school cases, and Justice Wiley Rutledge leaned into him and said, yeah, Mr. Hastie, wouldn't you say this thing is wrong in principle? And Hastie said, yeah, Your Honor, maybe, but that's not the argument we want to make. And a few minutes later, Justice Rutledge leaned in and said, yes, but Mr. Hastie, wouldn't you say it's wrong in principle? And Bill Hastie said, I just gave him all kinds of blather that moment, a few minutes, because I didn't want him asking that question. That's not the question we wanted to ask. We wanted to keep it limited to what the effects are of segregation in this particular case. The whole strategy of the NAAC at this moment was simply to argue in a piecemeal way about what may be the ill effects or the harms done by segregation in this particular school while skirting around the question of what may be right or wrong with it in principle. And the result of that now is that we have a thriving system of racial preferences running through our laws of employment and contracting. And of course, the whole scheme of diversity appointees and racial preferences in college admissions, none of which would be tenable if people had ever come to the judgment. It is simply wrong to draw inferences of worth, the moral worth of anybody, on the basis of knowing race, as though race determined something of more significance about the character of this person.
How are conservatives often lured into relativistic reasoning?
We see this in the doctrines of speech and even in understanding religion, that Americans think that we can defend the freedom of conservatives to speak on the campuses by coming to the notion that there are no moral grounds for restricting speech. One line from Justice Alito and Gorsuch, that the bedrock of the First Amendment is that we cannot restrict speech because it is offensive. Well, it seems to suggest there's nothing offensive in point of principle. We've recognized for many years in the way language operates that some language works, that language and gestures work to inflict harm, to insult, to incite hatred. And when that happens, we should be able to judge those acts as we judge any other act and understand whether that act is directed to an end that is justified or unjustified. In the case of religion, we find our friends thinking we can give a fuller defense of religion if we withdraw any grounds on which to draw any moral judgment about religions that may be legitimate or illegitimate. So we simply fall back upon a notion of sincerity. But by this construction, we've seen a new growth industry for Satanists in this country in giving invocations at legislative assemblies. And some of our friends arguing that, well, religion should include Satanism because people hold to that judgment with the passion of religion. And so we can't make any judgments about the substance of what a religion teaches. Now, you recall the Declaration of Independence, the appeal to the author of nature's laws, the creator who endowed us with rights, the author of the laws of nature, including the moral laws. The God of the Declaration of Independence was not a God who was ready to entertain as legitimate the affirmation of radical evil. When we come to this point where we seek to defend religion, we seek to defend speech by saying there are no moral grounds on which to tell the difference between legitimate and illegitimate, religions that are more or less legitimate, or speech that is more or less legitimate. Well, what you're saying is that if there's no moral ground to talk about speech that is better or worse, there's no moral ground on which to judge speech or religion as a good. If moral relativism is the key premise, then we lose the ground on which to say there's something about religion that makes it a good we want to protect and nurture and preserve. And this freedom of speech, what makes it a good if there are no standards to tell us what is better or worse in speech? So I think what you find here is conservatives thinking that they're going to be clever and trying to be protective have fallen into a strategy of relativism that simply cuts the ground from under their position. A friend of mine brought on some tract of Benito Mussolini from the 20s saying, the great virtue of relativism is that it shows there can't be anything wrong with what we're doing ourselves in pressing our own program. Nobody could find any fault with it because there are no grounds of moral judgment to judge anything we do. Now, for conservatives to pull themselves into that kind of posture is to put themselves in a position of moral incoherence. And part of the problem dealing with the reason we brought forth this book on mere natural law is to try to restore to young lawyers and old lawyers the sense that there really is a moral ground to the law, the moral ground that the American founders understood. And what we're finding, Todd, is that through reports of many young lawyers who feel there's been something gone awry with this version of conservative jurisprudence that we've been said that we can't reach questions of moral substance. We can deal with this question of transgenderism without addressing the question of what objectively sex is. It's just put out of reach, as though the judges can't reach that kind of a question. So we find ourselves in a position in which, as Anthony Stevens says, that he regards himself as a woman. And the finding is the people around him are obliged to respect that judgment. If they don't respect it, they'll be constituting a hostile work environment. And the conservatives in trying to deal with this question are asking the question, well, what does sexual discrimination mean in the Civil Rights Acts, going back to 1964, 1972? But it runs beyond it. It's not a matter of looking at the dictionaries. The Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith years ago pointed out that there's not always been an Italy or a Hungary. But as long as there are human beings, there must be males and females. That is the meaning of sexuality, the telos, the purpose of sexuality. Now, it's a really mark of a state that we're in, where conservative jurists have to address that question, and somehow they think they cannot appeal beyond the statutes to the objective, inescapable truth that lies at the heart of the matter. So what you're seeing here is, as I've told you, we have this program, the James Wilson Institute, which we're doing seminars with young lawyers, and with bringing together judges and professors. And some judges, young and old, have been sending us their clerks, people newly sprung from law schools. And because the young people and the judges themselves have a sense that there's something not quite working well here in a jurisprudence, a conservative jurisprudence, that finally can't give a coherent account of itself. A jurisprudence that tries to deal with Roe versus Wade, with abortion, while being unwilling to pronounce on the question of whether that offspring in the womb is human. One of the signs here was Justice Kavanaugh in the Dobbs opinion last June saying, isn't it curious we're so divided in this country with different opinions? There are pro-lifers who think that a fetus is a human being, who argue that the fetus, what do you mean argue that it's a human being? It's a point well established in embryology over many, many years. In other words, why is a conservative judge thinking it's a matter of his canons of jurisprudence, his code of jurisprudence, that he cannot pronounce on the objective truth of that offspring in the womb? If he could do that, if he would pronounce on the human state of the child in the womb, then the matter would be sent back to the states, where the people in the states are told, we're dealing here with the taking of human life. You have to figure out how the taking of this life is going to be reconciled with the other laws on homicide, because, after all, the laws on homicide have ever been indifferent, as I said, to the size and age weight of the victim. And if we establish that point, that we're dealing with a human being, a small human being, then the 14th Amendment kicks in for both federal judges and for the Congress, because now the Congress has a ground to act to protect the lives of unborn children. If the laws in the blue states, the laws in the blue states now, are withdrawing the protections of the law from a whole class of human beings in the womb. Do you not see that they're human? If they are human, then why does all this follow? Why is there not a ground for the Congress to act to protect unborn children in those liberal states? But and you have to ask, why have we fallen into this kind of condition in which conservative jurisprudence must begin on this question by accepting affably a radical falsehood that we cannot pronounce on whether we're dealing with a human being? The conservatives will say, it's a potential human being, as Justice Alito say. But, well, it may be a potential outfielder, but it's never been a potential human being. Now, Justice Alito gave us a wonderful opinion in which he showed that there was no principled ground on which to regard that child in the womb as anything other than human, but he held back from drawing the conclusion that sprung from that analysis. He assumed this was something that had to be given over to people in political office. Well, my own hunch is that if we're going to make any headway here, we'll have to fall to a federal judge to pick up the cue, and perhaps for Alito himself to come back to it if the issue is raised again, and finally draw the conclusion. It may happen when a judge dealing with a case in the blue states, this here's a guardian ad litem coming in to try to offer protection to a child, and a judge says, Justice Alito has shown that there's no principled ground for denying the human standing of the child in the womb. Therefore, the Constitution must protect him. That's all open. But again, what I'm pointing to, what's bringing forth again, another try to look again in a different way at the natural laws, to remind people that we needn't put up with a jurisprudence lacking moral coherence, that it cannot be inept for us to move beyond the text of the statute to appeal to the objective truth that lie beyond the text.
So what was missing from the majority decision of Dobbs?
That's exactly what I told you now. And the dissenters nailed it. They said, look, the status of the child, there's no relation. The holy is that the court in Roe versus Wade did something wrong by injecting itself into a field where it had no business, because abortion is not contained in the logic of the Constitution. We take a look at the early statutes and say we don't find in those early statutes any right to abortion. That's just not part of our tradition. It would make a profoundly, you know, what's engaged here, you've probably heard me say before, in looking at the history, the historical record, is the old problem of Plato's Euthyphro. Is the old good because it is old, or has it become old because there's something about it enduringly good? Those earlier statutes on abortion, do we respect them because they're old, or because they're based on an understanding of embryology, which is as true for us now as it was then? That is not the move made by the conservative judges. The conservative judges steered around, thought they had to steer around carefully the question of whether the child in the womb is human. As Justice Scalia once said, that's a value judgment. We're sending that out to states to make a value judgment. Well, value judgment is a term that came from Nietzsche and Max Weber. It's the kind of term that people use when they stopped speaking moral truths and said, well, things as moral value as we impute moral value to them. The child in the womb has moral value as it somehow matters to us to treat that child in the womb as a human being with moral value. Well, when you're sending it out to the states in that way, you're saying, well, there's no truth to the matter. It's all a matter of your beliefs and your own coming to the judgment of how important is it for you to treat that child in the womb as a human being. That radically transformed the situation. But this is what Justice Kavanaugh suggests. He said the Constitution is neutral in the way that Stephen Douglas, back in the debates with Lincoln, thought that the Constitution was neutral on slavery. It contained no moral grounds for judging slavery to be wrongful. In this case, Justice Kavanaugh, in a kind of curious way, channeling Stephen Douglas, saying, the Constitution is neutral. It really brings back the old argument from Lincoln about the degradation of the democratic dogma to say the whole system is just process and no substance. You're free to choose anything through this democratic regime, free to choose slavery, free to choose genocide, as long as you do it in a legitimate way with the trappings of legality. And so the question Kavanaugh's opinion raises is, do you think the Constitution, say, would be neutral on the matter of genocide, of killing the innocent? Well, if that's the case, why would you think the deep principles of the American government would be utterly indifferent on the question of whether we should be licensing the killing of innocent small human beings in the womb? Once again, it's a matter of conservative jurisprudence detaching itself from the deep moral grounds of this American Republic.
Hadley Arkus is our guest. We're talking natural law and the U.S. Constitution. What is the future of natural law on the U.S. Supreme Court?
Church music directors can find a new community at Prelude to Postlude, the CPH music blog. Learn helpful tips for managing music ministry and involving members, and meet the composers of some of your favorite new pieces. Plus, find suggestions of music to use for special services, and preview some of our newest works with free samples you can use at your church. Visit us at preludetopostlude.org.
They've met with the pastor week after week. He's taught them our precepts and Christ Jesus to seek. He shared the law of our God, which we strive to keep, the prayers, the creeds, and the sacraments deep. Now these young saints are right to partake in Christ's body and blood, all for his sake. A gift you are seeking to commemorate this? Ad Crucem has just what you won't want to miss. We've got icons, art, ornaments, jewelry, and more, greeting cards, crucifixes, posters, gifts galore. Your catechized friend will love what you give and treasure the gift all the days that they live.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
You wish your classical school could do more for struggling learners, uncertain where to begin? The Memoria Press Schools Division includes Cheryl Swope, author of Simply Classical, A Beautiful Education for Any Child. The Schools Division will happily assist your school. Memoria Press offers an entire line of special needs resources for teaching math, reading, spelling, and more. Contact schools at memoriapress.com or order directly from simplyclassical.com with coupon code LPR23.
I'm Pastor Watson. Are you tired of entertainment and in need of the peace that passes human understanding? I invite you to Augsburg Lutheran Church in Shawnee, Kansas, to receive the gifts of Jesus. Augsburg is scriptural, traditional, historical, sacramental, and reverent. The Church of the Apostles, the Councils, and the Reformers wants to be your church family also. For more information, visit us at augsburglutheranchurch.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Hadley Arkus about natural law and the U.S. Constitution. Hadley, what is the future of natural law in the U.S. Supreme Court?
I hope it's coming back. We had good reaction to the book. But also, as I mentioned to you, more judges are sending clerks our way. They have a sense something else is needed here. There's something not quite right with this conservator's proof that cannot reach the takes pride in steering around the moral substance of the matter. You know, in this program of ours, we do a major seminar in the fall with some leading students, people just coming out of law school on their way to clerkships. Some have gone on to the Supreme Court, but now we've had two recent things where someone came to us after already serving on the Supreme Court. One young woman who came to us after she served as a clerk for John Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts. And I asked her, God, why are you in this seminar? And she said, I'm here to get what I never had at Harvard at the law school. I think that sense is settling in among many people. And if it settles in deep enough and has quite the effect we're seeing the signs of now, we may raise our hopes that people will come to that, because they realize, it's like you hear these precepts of common sense, and when you hear them, you realize you've known them all your life. But suddenly the natural law, the premises of natural law, the precepts of common sense are just made known to people. So don't you realize you've been acting upon them? The natural law hasn't been missing. It's been there all the time. The judges, it leaves through everything you do. You know, I used to raise the question, for the judge to get through the day without using the natural laws, like asking the question, can I order the coffee without using syntax? I mean, it's just woven into everything they do. The principles and the precepts of common sense are just so natural that you may hardly be aware that you're using them.
So why is originalism not enough?
Because it produces the kind of jurisprudence I've just been talking about. It simply concentrates on text, and it detaches our understanding of the Constitution from those principles that were there before the text. So when you see people, some originalists now saying, that when a judge departs from the text of the Constitution, he's simply looking inside himself. In other words, the assumption now is that once you leave the text, there are no truths outside the text. No truths like presumed innocent till proven guilty. No one should be held accountable, responsible for act he was powerless to effect, and so on. We know that's not true. We know that the founders were quite aware of those truths. The founders didn't think, in fact, the critical point is that the founders never thought they had to put into the Constitution everything they knew. And the Constitution, again, was not the source of their knowledge of these things. So, again, Richard, we do. I teach the American founding. I've taught it. I've had the sublime experience of teaching the writings of Hamilton, Marshall, James Wilson. And I think that is the path back to read again those luminous writings of the people who made the Constitution, who had a remarkable knack for tracing their judgments back to those truths that were there before the Constitution as a way of explaining the anchoring grounds of their own judgment. It's there to be learned. It's there to be learned anew. It's accessible to us. But once again, the problem is, yes, originalism as it originally was. Yes, we want to understand what the Constitution meant, to respect it as it was written, but understand also that in order to apply the Constitution, at times you really must go back to the principles that were there before the text in order to apply the Constitution sensibly to the cases coming before us.
Hadley Arkus is Emeritus Professor of Jurisprudence at Amherst College. He's founder of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights in the American Founding, architect of the bill that became the Born Alive Infants Protection Act, and author of several books, including his latest, Mere Natural Law, Originalism, and the Anchoring Truths of the Constitution. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Hadley, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Jane Robbins joins us on the other side of the break to talk about the normalization of pedophilia.
Register today. The 2023 Lutherans for Life National Conference is October 11th through the 13th at the Holiday Inn Cincinnati Airport in Erlanger, Kentucky. The conference includes visits to the Ark Encounter and Creation Museum. Online registration is open now with early bird pricing at lutheransforlife.org/conference. Lutherans for Life, equipping Lutherans and their neighbors to be gospel-motivated voices for life. lutheransforlife.org.
Terry Mattingly is the eternal boomer. In other words, he, due to the circumstances of his birth, is lame.
Here's some feedback from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Terry can be counted on to deliver his boring, blasé takes in his irritatingly pseudo-profound fashion. Anyway, lame. May God have mercy on Terry and Issues Etc. You're all a bunch of lame boomers.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
Not all churches teach the truth. This shouldn't surprise us, since Jesus warned us that false teachers would arise after he ascended into heaven. So how then does a Christian find a church? By looking for her marks. The May issue of the Lutheran Witness will teach you so much more about these marks, their biblical foundations, and how to find a church marked in this way. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe, or visit our website, witness.lcms.org, to learn more. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Luther Academy provides additional theological education for our mission partners around the world, specifically pastors who are asking for additional education but do not have the necessary resources in their own church bodies. By donating to Luther Academy today, you will be supplying food, housing, books, professors, and travel for Lutheran pastors who attend our conferences. To learn more about Luther Academy and how you can donate today, visit lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com.
Talk radio for the Christian worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples. And you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free.
Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University, Chicago.
Indeed, the quest for truth is at the core of a university's purpose. The liberal arts, illuminated by the revealed truths of Scripture, are powerful for equipping students for a life of self-governance. A disciple is one who follows the master. So what does it mean to follow Jesus? He said that it means to take up one's cross. The cross is thus the symbol of dying for others, of dying to self for the sake of serving others. And a life of service is a life well lived.
Truth, Freedom, Vocation. Concordia University Chicago. CUChicago.edu.